Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome this evening. Welcome to Education is Freedom, the podcast. My name is Dr. Danny, your favorite host, your favorite educator. This is a space where we discuss all things education. And as we know, education takes place both inside and outside of the classroom. And so in this space, we invite fearless, purpose-driven leaders, change makers, and advocates from all over to discuss their craft. So tonight, I have one of my favorite people on with me this evening, Dr. Kristen Austin. So I'm going to read some of her bio, then she's going to step in the room and we're going to get it popping. Dr. Kristen Austin is a lover of talking, tacos, and Target, because who doesn't love Target? She's a professional helper and lifelong learner. She has accumulated 23 plus years of experience in the higher education sector, rotating as a senior level administrator, a full-time faculty member. Already I'm getting tied up because she does all the things, all within functional areas that promote diversity, access, inclusion, and retention. Starting with her first professional role as an admissions counselor, Dr. Austin designed and implemented a comprehensive multicultural student recruitment campaign, the first of its kind at the university. From there, she continued crafting progressively responsible career experiences at domestic and international universities, while always centering the personal and academic success of underrepresented student populations. Simultaneous to pursuing research and professional endeavors that emphasize equity, Dr. Austin also became offering inclusion and diversity education to small businesses and teams via her nonprofit, KE Advancement Incorporated. Rooted in a posture of cultural humility, Dr. Austin's goal is to catalyze individuals and structures to question who is at the table, who is missing from the table, for whom was the table built, and who is unaware the table exists. Dr. Austin currently serves as Vice President of IDEAS. It's an acronym which stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access for Rewriting the Code, or RTC. Dr. Austin holds a doctorate in higher education leadership and administration, a professional certificate in diversity, equity, and inclusion, a master's degree in counseling, and a bachelor's degree, her favorite degree, in social work. For the past 14 years, she has also been enrolled in Parent University, where she has been blessed to learn from three small and forgiving professors, ages 15, 13, and 9. Dr. Austin is also married to a fellow educator, and for three reasons, her favorite getaway is to go to Target by herself. Who doesn't love Target? Dr. Austin, come in the room, honey. Yes.
Oh my God. Listen, we got to go in Target. Target is therapy.
We have to go on a field trip because
we really do. Them aisles be calling.
Well, first of all, Tabitha Brown got her snacks back in there.
Yes, she does.
And she's my cousin in my head, so I need to go get some popcorn and all of that.
Well, if she's your cousin, she's mine then.
So. Then we got to go see Tab. Welcome to Education is Freedom. I'm so glad you can join me this evening.
I'm so glad to be here.
And so we heard a little bit about your bio. We're just going to jump right into it. Okay, so like the format of the show is a couple questions, some laughs, some kikis, and then we're gonna send you on your way to Target.
Yeah.
So the first question I want to ask you is, you know, I just want to highlight more of your educational journey. Like, how did you land at this point? Like, we heard a little bit in your bio, but like, how did you land at this point in your career, and what motivates you to be in this space?
That is such a good question. Oh my goodness, it's such a good question. So my entire professional career, like 19 and a half years I spent in higher education on like brick and mortar, traditional green campuses. And then out of nowhere, completely out of nowhere, a friend that I had gone to graduate school with posted a role in DEI at a tech-based nonprofit, a tech-based higher ed adjacent nonprofit. And something that I'm very proud of is I have ADHD. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is important to me. It makes me who I am. It's a great, very salient part of my identity. But part of that ADHD means that I am constantly curious. Okay. I am constantly curious. So when this friend of mine from graduate school posts this role, I was like, 19 years in public education, incredible benefit package. I'm almost vested, salary good. Of course I'll leave for a startup nonprofit. Who wouldn't make such a choice? So literally, that's that curiosity piece. And that's that spontaneity that ADHD really cultivates in me. I'm just in a constant state of curiosity. And so as I was reviewing the role and reflecting on 19 plus years in higher ed, I was just like, if I don't do it, I will spend a long time wondering what it would have been like. And I also rested on the privilege that I knew I could come back to higher ed, proper higher ed. I call it exactly proper higher ed because I'm still in higher ed. So it just, the balance of why not was way, way, way in the favor of taking a leap than it was in like staying comfortable. So that's really what brought me here. When I talk to my students, I often say what brought me here is actually a network and talking about privilege. Like Jade is someone who I went to graduate school with. Going to graduate school is a privilege. And because we went to graduate school together, she was in my network, which allowed for this role.
I
tell the students all the time who you are, who you present as, who you show up as online, in person, that you're constantly building your network and you never know what that's going to lead to.
Right. So, that's good. That's good. I just did a workshop on networking last week and it was with adults. And some folks just don't realize that your network is your net worth.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And how to move within it, how to leverage it.
Right.
And it's actually kind of funny because when Jade was also in higher ed, like we both have student affairs master's degrees. That's what we got together. And she was working at UNC Chapel Hill when she left and went to this nonprofit. And it's so funny because I said to her, I was like, Jade, how the heck are you going to leave your job at Chapel Hill and go work at a startup nonprofit?
Yeah.
Sounds fun. And here then I end up doing the same thing like 4 years later. But I also think that shows that it's risks are worth taking and that technically speaking, your career is just one big risk. That's literally what it is. Your career is one risk after another. It's applying for a promotion. It's going for a leadership position. It's raising your hand for additional projects. Those are all risks anyway. Mm-hmm. So you might as well take some control of them and try to drive that a little bit. So that's
I like that. I like that perspective. I don't know that enough of us look at it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. And so your bio mentions that, you know, you are the VP of ideas.
Yes.
Tell us about that. What does that mean? Tell us all about that.
So I'm actually really proud of that title, and not for reasons that people might think, not for like the initials or not for the title in its in terms of the role, but I'm proud of what the title represents. So when I originally came into rewriting the code, the role was director of DEI, and that kind of nomenclature is very popular and common, and I'm anything but common, first of all. And then second, every time folks talk about DEI, I'm always adding the A, because DEI, and the A stands for access, because DEI is absolutely nothing if people cannot access it.
Oof.
If you can, so what I've shared in other circles is DEI without the A is a store full of wheelchairs, but the store is locked. Like what good is the beautiful edifice of an institution, a university with no elevator? So when I was negotiating, coming on to rewriting the code, joining this incredible organization, again, here's the risk. Here's the curiosity part of me. I said to our founder and president, her name is Sue Harnett, an incredible visionary leader, founder, all the things. I said, how do you feel about me changing up the title a little bit to add in that access piece? And she like leaned in. She's like, tell me more. What do you mean by that? Or where would you like to take that? And so I basically just described what I just outlined here, saying, if we're going to do this right, and I didn't mention this, but my role was the inaugural DEI role with the organization. So it was so important to me that we get this right. And I said, if you don't mind, if we add that A piece, that is going to take what we do to another level. Because everything that we do will be framed from the lens of how do we get, in our case, more women. How do we give more women access to technology careers? Diversity is inherently present. No matter where you are, if there's more than one person in the room, there's going to be diversity. Inclusion, that's going to exist because there are two people in a space. Like it doesn't mean that it's being celebrated, but it is present. Inclusion is present because two people are in a space. So the access is the game changer. Lots and lots of companies like to talk about their DEI vision and strategy and goals, and that's great. But I'm always looking for the holes of who's actually benefiting from this thing because they have access to this thing. She's like, I would love to take it in that direction. So add the A. And then I just came up with Director of Ideas. And then maybe 2 years later, maybe I was promoted to Vice President. So
yes.
Exciting. Okay.
Very exciting. Well, congratulations on the promotion, but that's amazing. And I loved how you painted the picture of, you know, a university with no elevators. And like when you paint that picture, it's like, oh, yeah.
All performative. It's just sitting there looking pretty and performative. Nobody has access. Nobody. It's like the FAFSA. It's all these systems. But if you cannot get through the form, if you can't get through on the website, what is it all? It's all smoke and mirrors. And I don't want that.
Which is the struggle right now.
So relevant.
Now, this isn't on my questions I sent you, but I love the who is at the table, who was missing from the table, for whom was the table built? Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Can we? The table built. I'll stay on the... Which identity do I want to choose? Okay, so the workplace the American Western workplace is very, very much centered on those that do not have caregiving responsibilities. It is just the Western American workplace centers on those without caregiving responsibilities. And so that is a really good example of for whom was the table built. So the workplace was not built for people that maybe have to make it to a bus stop to get children to or from, or caregiving for parents. The workplace wasn't built with nursing mothers in mind. The workplace wasn't built for childcare in every setting. And then society wasn't built around esteeming the necessity for childcare. And that's because years ago, the woman stayed home. So so as businesses were being developed, there was no infrastructure in place to have a daycare, to have these really comprehensive women's health benefits. It just wasn't there. And that's a critical example of saying for whom were the systems built. They're built for people that do not have caregiving responsibilities. They're built for people who are not disabled. They're built for people who are able to conceive naturally. So when you think about all these identities that are missing, It's really because the table wasn't built for them.
Ooh.
It was built for a certain height, right? It was built for a certain height, certain ability level.
And we tend to only focus on, you know, a very small piece of, you know, which in my brain right now, I'm just thinking about race.
Yeah.
But all that you just said.
All the other things. Ability and age diversity. You know, our workplace has changed so much post-quarantine. And there's such a huge reliance on technology, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but there's a big threat to the wisdom of our older generation of workers who are really being pushed out, but they have so much wisdom to offer, so much historical knowledge, and technology really does a good job, unfortunately, of pushing that wisdom out and trying to replace it with artificial wisdom, artificial intelligence. And I definitely understand that systems evolve, and they should, that we, they should, but that diversity piece, it can't just be all millennials and Gen X. Like, we need that stability and that wisdom of generations that have navigated more than COVID, which is what our generation has really navigated. So all the types of diversity. Race is the most obvious, because it is visible. So it's a good one to default to. And certainly the list, the laundry list of problems associated with race-based violence and race-based discrimination, you could do a podcast on that alone. But there are so many other forms of diversity that also deserve attention and and may actually be easier to remedy. Sometimes they're easier to remedy than building a
Nobody's talking about that though. We tend to get so laser focused just on one that it's just whatever. Yeah. For the rest of y'all.
Right. And intersectionality.
Figure it out.
Yeah. That intersectionality is critical.
So let me ask you this. You do a lot of work with women in tech.
Yes.
So how would you empower young women, specifically young women of color, to seek out tech, STEM, STEAM opportunities? And just for the nerds like me, do you have any like interesting statistics you can share with us?
I have some really not interesting, but problematic statistics to share.
Okay. Well, those are good too, because we need to know.
We need to scratch them.
I hope y'all taking notes out there. See, I got my pen. Always got my pen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, take the notes because it's problematic. We need to do better. Actually, I'll start with the statistics and then talk about kind of what my advice, like the first part of your question. There's a few I want to offer. I chose three. I mean, these statistics can, oh my gosh, they're as deep as the ocean. But so get this one, catch this. Students. College students, irregardless of gender, are 81% less likely to have a woman-identifying STEM professor at any point in their collegiate career. Any point. 81% less likely to have a woman-identifying STEM professor. That is a problem. And so... Some of the skeptics, let's invite them to the table, might say, well, then there's obviously, it can't possibly be that they're not getting equal opportunity to be professors. Can't possibly be that. What it actually probably is that there are just less of them earning terminal degrees. Please hold for next statistic.
Please hold.
No, please hold. In the U.S., women make up less than 28% of STEM professors, but wait a minute, despite the fact that they earn over 40% of STEM PhDs.
Wait.
Let me give it to you again, because it's problematic, okay? In the U.S., women make up less than 28% of STEM professors. So all STEM professors, women are less than 28%. However, women earn 40% of the STEM PhDs. Mm-hmm. So that means they are earning these degrees. They're earning them. There's not quite gender parity. We're almost at parity, but they're earning the degrees, but they're not getting the faculty and the academic roles. And once again, I can hold space for a skeptic. So a skeptical person might say, well, they probably just don't want the jobs as much as the, well, no, mm-hmm. no.
Mm-mm. That ain't it. That ain't it.
They are not getting the opportunities.
You're not going to go get a whole STEM PhD and not want the job, skeptic.
Yeah. So, you know, and we could go on and on. We could even take the STEM part out. We could take that out. We could replace it with another field. But I'm an adjunct professor. I used to be a full-time professor. Now I'm an adjunct professor. I teach at Kutztown University. Go Bears. Golden Bears. And one of the questions I always ask my classes, like first day, is like, am I your first woman professor? Usually not, especially since I teach mostly education majors, social work majors, things like that. So usually the answer is no. Sometimes it's yes, not mm-hmm. usually. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, mm-hmm. we have complicated that part. We got mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, am I your first Black woman professor? Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly. And the reason that that is so problematic is because I teach graduate students. That these cherubs, these little angel face, have made it through an entire undergraduate career and have only, or not have only, because I don't know what they have been exposed to, but they haven't had a Black woman professor. That is a problem. That is a problem, especially, again, going back to the discipline that I teach in. I teach education majors. I teach ed leaders, superintendents, school counselors. Who among us needs diversity of pedagogy more than the future educators?
Chow, say it again for the people in Congress. So, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So okay, y'all. I hope y'all better be out there taking notes, because you know when you come to Education is Free, when you come to class with Dr. Danny, it's notes time.
No,
I'm gonna have to keep telling y'all to come to class prepared. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was my little side note. So then, Lord have mercy. So in your role at RTC, part of what you do is to help empower women to step in some of these roles or encourage them. Like, what does that look like for you? How do you do that?
Love that, because I love rewriting the code. I love our mission. One thing I do want to do quickly, as a scholar and as a very someone that knows that receipts matter, I do want to credit the statistics that I gave, because I didn't do that earlier. 2023 study by the American Association of University Women. So that 2023 study is deep. It's deep. And I just pulled those two statistics from it. But AAUW's report, anyone can find that. So AAUW's 2023 report. I said, get you some tea, because you'll be reading that thing mad.
Mad.
Just mad. So get some tea. But
wow,
turning that around to something more positive, very many organizations recognize the disparity between racial and gender inequity in all fields, not all, like education, there are some fields that are more heavily women or more heavily occupied by women, but there are lots of organizations out here that recognize that gender and racial inequity in careers, specifically tech, is a problem. Mm-hmm. And organizations realize and recognize that innovation goes further, faster, stronger when there's diversity at the table.
Yeah.
So Rewriting the Code is one of those organizations. We are a nonprofit organization that serves, connects, equips, fires up women in undergraduate through early career that are interested in tech. So what we really want to do is, if there's a woman who is a major, has a tech major or tech related major on her campus, we don't care where she goes to school, she's on her campus, RTC wants to wrap its arms around that student and keep her enrolled, despite the challenges, despite the microaggressions, despite the genderisms, despite the imposter syndrome. If that student, if that student wants to be an engineer, we want them to be an engineer. And then once we get them through graduation, then we're going to hold them even tighter, because we want to keep them in their software engineering or any engineering tech-based career. And if we can keep them in for up to 5 years, the research shows that that is that turning point where A, they're more likely to stay in tech, and B, they're more likely to ascend to a leadership role. So that year undergrad and that 4 to 5 year out of grad post-graduation, those are so critical for women in tech. And those are the critical years that RTC focuses on. Like, just want to wrap our arms around you and keep you, but not just wrap our arms around you from a holding perspective, but also a lifting perspective.
Like, right. So I was going to ask you what that looks like. Does that look like mentorship?
Mentorship. It's in-person events. It's online events. It is a virtual community that lives in Slack. I always say we live in Slack and we party in person. It's a bad joke, but I love it. Okay. So we appreciate the laughter. What we do is year-round curricular support. We sort of operate like an online university, but without the classes. And that's on purpose, because we want the schools to do the teaching. Teach code, Java, HTML, C++. We don't do any of that.
We're just here for support.
We're here for the support. We're here that when Dr. Danny, well, before Dr. Danny was doctor, when Danny is sitting in her classroom as a CS major, a sophomore student, and she's the only woman in her class, and her professor is not calling on her, and the males around her are trading answers and intentionally leaving her out of the conversation, what we want is for Danny to leave that class when class is over, go to her residence hall, go to her apartment, open up her laptop, log into the RTC Slack channel, and be overwhelmed by the amount of support
she's
going to get based on what just happened. And that is what happens in the Rewriting the Code Slack community.
That's so good.
It's, oh, I know, that same thing happened to me. Oh, it's awful. This is what I did. Here's my strategy. Oh, we got you, girl. All uplifting. No competition. There's no tech bro culture.
And it's helping to build their network.
That
you mentioned earlier.
That piece. Because when gets in, a woman is going to hold the door open for someone else.
Yes.
It's not about competition. It's about collaboration. And women go further when they go together. Mm-hmm. So we're making sure we go together.
That's so good. There's over
25,000 of them. Actually, it might be 26. It might be 26,000.
Across the country or internationally?
Globally.
Oh, yes. Come on, women.
Listen, these software engineers, and it's also about intersectionality. Are they software engineers? Yes. Or they're not just software engineers. They represent a multitude of functional areas in tech. But one of our values is that tech does not define us. It unites us. So some of our students, maybe theater majors, minoring in computer science. We want you in the space if you feel that you don't belong in the space that you're in. We have space for you.
So listen. Come on here. Let me say this plug real quick. Plug. So you know this podcasting network that we're on is all female led, female design, global, all the things. So I'm listening and I'm like,
love it.
Sound like some female tech leaders.
Yes.
We're going to need to talk.
We sure will.
That's amazing. That's so much amazing.
Yep. So much talent. You'd be blown away. You'd be like, what? Oh my gosh. The things that they're creating and doing. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Okay. All right. Yeah, snaps for that. So, okay. So let me ask you this too. So I know you do some work related to neurodiversity.
I do.
That's a big word here. Big fancy academic word. Can you tell us what that is? What the word means?
What it is. All the things. So,
and how we can hold space for that.
And please do. Please hold space for us. So I identify as neurodiverse because I there's other titling that we also use called 2E, twice exceptional. I have a learning disability and I also have ADHD. And the combination of those wonderful diagnoses both make life complicated, but also make me very strong. I describe neurodiversity like yoga. You know, it's hard, but it's strength building. It's hard,
okay,
but it's strength building. And that's what yoga is. But neurodiversity, from a clinical perspective, really just describes atypicalities in the ways in which individuals receive information, interpret that information, and then send that information back out. It's a very broad umbrella term for how people interact with interaction, interact with information, how they interact with the world. And the world is built for and based on neurotypical standards, just like it's built for and based on able-bodied identities. But neurodivergent individuals experience the world differently. Mm-hmm. So for me, what that looks like, so my learning disability is called dyscalculia. It is the cousin, sibling, whatever, partner of dyslexia. So most people know what dyslexia is, but they don't often know about dyscalculia. So essentially with dyscalculia, it's my brain does not interact with numbers in a value-based way. So I know conceptually what a 4 is, but I don't always know what a 4 looks like. I know what 100 is as a number, but I don't always know what 100 of a thing is. So the number itself is nothing more than a word. Mm. It's just a word. And so if you say, go 10 miles, to me, that's the same as saying go banana miles. It's just a word. It has no value. So I struggle very much with time management, but specifically time. I struggle with directions. I struggle with measurements, estimating, budgeting. And fortunately, I have workarounds and supports and accommodations for all of these things. But it doesn't make it easy if I'm standing in a grocery store and someone's like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And I'm attempting to do like mental math, which is a total disaster. So that's dyscalculia. It's just a processing difference related to values, values, big quantities, things like that. The strength of it, though, is that because I only process words, I love words and I love language and I love being colorful with words and colorful with language. And I love adding contour to a story. I just can't do it with numbers. They have no value. Yeah. So that's what I like. A lot of people are very black and white, very 1 + 1 = 2. Whereas I'm like, well, but it could equal 4 if you add some pink on the side. Like, I just have a totally different perspective. So that's dyscalculia. And then ADHD in the shortest sense of the word, or the shortest sense of the diagnosis or the identity, however a person associates, is I use the people entering a door as the best visual. So if you have ADHD, you think of it as you're in an auditorium and there are 500 people that need to get through. That need to get through a door to get into the auditorium. So maybe they're in the lobby. With ADHD, your brain will try to get all 500 people through one door. The neurotypical brain can separate and say, we need this door, we need this door. And the neurotypical brain can guide people through those doors. So you take those people and you interchange that with stimuli, information, everything going on around you. All of that is coming into your brain at the same time, but you only have one door. So the cool thing about it is that even though you constantly feel like you're having information overload, the cool thing is that you have a lot of information. So you're able to draw from such disparate and unexpected sources to create solutions.
Mm-hmm.
While a neurotypical brain put, I don't know, last names A through F in door number one and then close that door. Oh, I know A through F. I know T through Z. I know all of them. And I know what they're wearing. I know what they sound like. And I use all of that to create a thing. So yeah. I really do try to balance both because it is hard. It's definitely hard to constantly be in a situation where you are taking on information, but you get to use that information in such cool ways.
I love that. I love all of that. I love your response. I love your energy and excitement behind it and how you identify. Thank you for your transparency because, you know, representation matters, right? We talk about that all the time. And I want whoever's listening, whoever identifies just as you do, who may be nervous about it, you know, bullied around it, like all the things, I want them to be able to hear this and find encouragement in that, you know, you broke it down. You know, and so for people who don't understand that, that was a very good, come on, professor.
Education is freedom.
Right.
It's so liberating.
Yeah. Yes, liberation. Like that was great. And as you were talking, I was again thinking about that table we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was so good. So good. So good. So another thing I love that you say, I love that you say that you are a lover of learning and unlearning.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Friend, I think that we all love to rest on what we've learned. And I mean social conditioning. I don't mean what we've learned in a textbook, although the textbooks are problematic as well. But I'm specifically referring to what we have been socially conditioned to accept as being okay. What we have been socially conditioned to be accept as the right thing or the professional thing or the standard of the thing. I don't separate myself from that. I'm a product of social conditioning as well. Mm-hmm. I live in the United States of America. I have been raised and steeped in our own supremacist ways. I have contributed to supremacy culture because of my own privilege and lenses. Mm. So being able to unlearn that I've been taught is more important to me than learning new things. I just say, if I never learn another thing, that's okay. Because if I'm unlearning all the not good stuff that I've been taught, that is going to be more impactful in repairing and healing than if I'm only on a quest for new knowledge. So sometimes when people are like, oh, good, pronouns now, I got to learn how to use a pronoun. I'm like, can you unlearn what it means to assume? Just start there. If you're not going to learn the pronouns, let's just unlearn. Assumption. What it means to assume how someone should act based on a gender or whatever. So, and that piece very often is harder. It's harder personally. Could be easier overall, but it's harder personally because it requires you to do way more self-work.
Don't nobody want to do no self-work.
They just want to go to the DEI training and say I'm an ally because I went to the training.
Because you know what self-work requires? Accountability.
That part. It also requires action.
Okay? Yeah.
It requires action. Is this a cell phone? It's not if I don't use it. Otherwise, it's a piece of glass. I don't know. Apple. It's glass. A thing is not a thing until you operationalize it. Your learning is useless if you're not using it to push equity, to advocate for causes. Otherwise, it's empty rhetoric, or useless tools, you know, just performative, you know.
That was good. The child, we can have a whole. We can have a separate podcast for every question I asked.
Every single one.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So then, as a last wrap up question, we've been talking about DEI, IDEA, DEIB.
DEIBJ, throw that justice in there.
Ooh, come on. Diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, and justice. And speaking of justice, how do you feel about the space we are now in as a country with regard to all those letters we just mentioned? It's so hard, right? You're so tired already. Like, I'd be tired.
Yeah. I'm tired because I'm not tired or surprised by what corporations have done. I am tired and hurt and frustrated by what universities have done. Because education is freedom, and education could be a massive beacon of equalizing access and opportunity and learning and unlearning, but not not if we are gonna take unlearning off the table.
Yep.
We're taking it off. And I just hurt for education because especially public education.
Yes, Lord.
I hurt for it. I hurt for our students who enter higher education as these emerging impressionable adults for whom sometimes they've never interacted with a person from a different religion. They don't know what it means to fast. They don't know different religions or different ability status. They don't know different ideologies. And the collegiate environment has historically supposed to be that the place that creates that dialogue. And I don't think you're going to get it in the workplace. And I don't think you're going to get it in K-12. And I don't think you're going to get it in an echo chamber of your own family and friends. So college was that thing. So that's where the hurt is. As I say, not the college, the corporations, I get it. I'm not saying I agree, but I get it. But college, the learning, like where the awareness, where the critical thinking, where's the critical thinking?
And where? So for us here in Pennsylvania right now on the table is HB 2041. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Tell the people.
The future looks scary. And the one thing, I am an eternal optimist, and the one thing that I have been processing and kind of deconstructing in my own mind about this situation is maybe we are burning it all down in order to rebuild it. Maybe what it's going to take is all of these leaders, thought leaders, influencers, whatever you want to call them, who start pulling out, keep the policies going, and then it all goes away. And then we have a generation that never learns inclusive language or is never exposed to critical race theory, or it never has a Black woman professor. And what does that generation end up looking like? Because we're still looking at the generation that was schooled during quarantine, and we're still learning what that looks like. So what does it look like to have an entire generation held hostage from critical thinking? But yeah, and as it relates to equity and belonging and justice, what is that going to look like? The only thing I can say that is positive is maybe we are burning it all down to rebuild it. It wouldn't be the first time we've had a movement in this country that burned it all down just to rebuild, you know?
I appreciate that perspective. It gives me a little bit of hope.
This much.
Because I had not looked at it like that.
It's so painful.
It is painful. Mm-hmm. It is painful.
Oh, and let me say this too, because a lot of people misunderstand when we take DEI-based programming out of institutions, out of universities, a lot of people think of it as, oh man, people are losing their jobs, or that institution isn't going to have any cultural diversity programming. But guess what? There are students there who are going to lose their scholarships, who are going to lose their housing, who are going to lose their ability to matriculate and pursue. Those are the major, major victims of this. Mm-hmm. Is the students whose opportunities to graduate are going to be thwarted because so many of the things that kept them enrolled have now been taken away. So it's not just about loss of jobs. I'm not just talking.
That's really why my heart hurts.
That's why it hurts.
They are the ones who are going to be suffering.
They're the ones that are going to suffer. So
in order to do something about that, mm-hmm. as you were talking about justice and all, do we do?
Vote. I don't want to politicize advice, but I want people to vote, because what I believe is that as you do your research about candidates, I think that the more people that do the most research will vote in a way that protects the future. I just think that will happen. So don't vote haphazardly. Don't vote based on what your mama said. Don't vote based on who's got the flashiest commercial.
Do your research.
Do your research and just ask the questions. You know, what is the perspective on public funding of education? What's the perspective on teacher salaries and, you know, civil rights? Like, what are the perspectives there? What does that voting track record look like? And mm-hmm. and then ask yourself, when you're doing that research, if you weren't you, if you didn't have the privileges that you have, whatever those are, would that person be the best candidate for you? Because we so often vote based on our own wants and needs, but I am a privileged, doctorate holding, home owning, able-bodied person. I can't just vote from my perspective.
That's right. Vote
for the single mom, for the undocumented, for the low income, for the disabled.
You're voting for others. Yes, 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 yes. And you're voting for the future, those to come from behind who we probably won't even meet.
No, it's the future, because my ancestors voted for me. Okay, that's why they went through what they went through, so that I could be here. And so what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna only vote for myself when my ancestors literally gave their life for me? Oh, no.
No, ma'am.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. No ham, no turkey, okay?
Not at all. Listen, Dr. Kristen Austin, thank you so very much. I absolutely love and adore you. Y'all, let me tell y'all something. Doc and I go way back.
Way back.
way back to Bobalobs and ponytails and summer programs.
Elementary, honey.
And elementary. She is just somebody who I've always loved. I love her and her mama.
You love my dad too. You know my dad.
I love her dad too.
My mama, my daddy.
I love her brother. I love the whole family.
Oh, the whole crew. And we love you.
I just want to say that I'm grateful for you and I'm so proud of you. And thank
I'm
you
grateful for you
sharing your time and your space with me.
Listen, so, back at
if y'all didn't take notes, then y'all need to go back and listen because there was a whole lot of gems dropped in there, okay? And then you can like and share with your friends and your mama. And your brother and your whole family. And so to all of you who continue to tune in, thank you so very much. I'm personally inviting you to stay plugged in to Education is Freedom every second and fourth Tuesday of the month on all major podcasting platforms under the She Is Still Dope Network. So until next time, keep shining and never stop learning.
Yay!